Sit down and buckle up. It's time for the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Pirate Monk Podcast.
How is it possible there's another episode?
We have many, many episodes. We do. They are coming fast and furious these days. We're having great conversations, and there's going to be another one today. But in the before we get to our guest,
yeah,
man,
how are you doing, Nate? Are you tired?
No, I've been home for 2 days. I actually came home rejuvenated and rested. I don't know who was behind this. I don't know how they pulled it off without me knowing what was going on, but somebody engineered a bit of a campaign where just as I was about to get on a plane, Mark Heinrich handed me a bag with a bunch of envelopes.
This is a plane coming back from the 2023 summit, the Samson Society summit that we just came back from. So you're about to get on the plane.
That's good context. Yeah.
You're about to come back.
Yep. And he said, here's a gift for you. And it was notes from Samson Brothers. And so on Monday, Allie and I sat down together and opened them together and read them together.
I loved when you told me you read them together.
Yeah.
Because she shares you with everybody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And tell, what was that like reading those together?
It was overwhelming. It really was. It was overwhelming. And, there's a lot of, you know, guys expressed a lot of gratitude to me. And I think guys understand that Samson Society would not have happened were it not for Allie. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
this is something that, and it's all in God's plan that it's gone the way it's gone. But it was very affirming and wonderful. I couldn't think of a better gift than those notes. It was beautiful. But hey, what a weekend.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yes, it was.
Adam Young
didn't make it easy on us.
No. But he met and exceeded all expectations. I thought his teaching was solid, was brilliant. But what impressed me as much as his preaching was the way he engaged the guys that were there. There were 200 guys in the room, and he said, interrupt me at any time. I love questions. He answered at least, I think, 50 questions over the course of.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
I described him to two people, I think possibly you, that he has KK Ray energy, that he would go from being very paternal, and KK can just be like a mom, feels like a mom hug when she's talking. And then and then all of a sudden there's something that kind of turns and she's like, I'm still a mom, but I'm a mama bear. And you would just get like, okay, I'm going to hit you with something hard right now. And I'm not going to flinch. You're grown ass men. You can take it. And I got that same, like in a very different way. He's nothing like her, but I had that same feeling of I feel safe.
Yeah.
But you are going to whack me.
Yeah.
So it was great. And I just love getting to see people and sit around campfires. I just can't turn in until nobody else is left at campfires. That's my favorite time is at night. And getting to meet new guys and getting to hug guys that I've known for years and generally get to see once a year in person. So great.
You know, one of the things I really enjoyed was on the last day on Sunday morning, we did the live survey thing. Mm-hmm. So there were survey questions, you know, just, kind of evaluation of the weekend and questions about what you liked and what you'd like for next year. Mm-hmm. But it was done live, with the results showing up instantly on screen so we could see kind of what other guys thought. Unless my memory is faulty, what guys valued most out of the weekend, as great as Adam was, as great as the venue was, as great as the workshops were, what they valued most was the fellowship time.
Yeah. And you know what? When I talk to new guys, that was the thing that blew them away the most. I really don't do other things that aren't Samson things, haven't for years.
Yeah.
And so I forget that this is shocking and surprising to a lot of people. And so I love talking to guys that were there for the first time, and there was a joy and even a little confusion. Like, when do you sneak in something that I'm going to say, yep, there's the bullshit I was looking for. Like, it was like watching some folks, I don't want to say resisting, but you feel the anxiety from years in religion
with
letting go and trusting that they could have the kind of bond and brotherhood that we experience on these weekends. And it's so special to me.
Well, and this is, you know, a longtime listeners to the podcast would be accustomed to this annual rhythm, that the first episode of the podcast after the retreat is recorded at the retreat. We always do that. The last thing we do is we do a live taping of the Pirate Monk podcast at the retreat. Well, this year on Sunday morning, as the minutes were ticking down and we had about an hour left on the place, and we had it on the schedule to record the podcast. But you and I both knew instantly that what was more important, more valuable, was to give these guys more time while they were there to talk, to hug, to swap phone numbers. You know, that what we needed was more fellowship time, and we can always tape another episode of the podcast. We didn't have to do it then.
Yeah, and I thought this was the best departure of any of our annual get-togethers by far.
Yeah. We got to say a long goodbye instead of rushing out the door.
Well, speaking of Russians, I want to get into this borscht of an interview. I know that didn't sound complimentary, but I was trying to think of anything Russian. it's time to get to the interview, because our guest today, I think our listeners are going to love, because he's talking about something that might at first thing like. Feel like it's not your wheelhouse, but I think you'll find it is all about you.
So stay with us. We'll be right back on the Pirate Monk Podcast. This episode of the Pirate Monk Podcast is sponsored by LifeWorks Counseling. Our good friends Ron and Eva Hunter and their son Ro are not just members of the Samson Society, the Sarah Society. They are also trauma-informed, certified sex addiction therapists with a tremendous amount of experience. Well, they and their team of counselors and recovery coaches are based in Madison, Mississippi, but thanks to the internet, they're able to work with people who live almost anywhere. So to find out more about what LifeWorks Counseling can do for you as an individual, or as a couple, or as a family, or to register for one of their upcoming intensives, go to lifeworks.ms, lifeworks.ms. And welcome back to the Pirate Monk Podcast. Our guest this week is an associate professor of leadership formation and a senior fellow at the Dupree Center for Leadership. He's a former pastor, a professor,
a fly fisherman.
He's also an author of a couple of great books: Canoeing the Mountains, Christian Leadership in Uncharted Territory, and more recently, Tempered Resilience: How Leaders Are Formed in the Crucible of Change. Todd Bolsinger is with us. Thank you, Todd. Welcome.
Thank you, Nate. Nice to be with you.
Crucibles and canoes. All right. I'm glad we're keeping it in the C family. But your jam is adaptive leadership. That's like your main focus, right?
Yep, that's the area I work in. Yep.
You know, the listeners all know that I'm surely aware of exactly what that means, but for their sake, could you Could you explain what that means?
Yeah. So adaptive leadership came from these two guys at Harvard University, Ronald Heifetz and Marty Linsky. They were talking about the kind of leadership needed when your old best practices don't work. So when you're having to lead in a changing environment and you have lots of experience and that experience no longer is relevant, and you actually find yourself in a position where you have to lead in real time while you're also learning as you go, it requires adaptive leadership. It's really the way in which healthy organizations have to adapt to a changing environment in order to thrive and continue to fulfill their mission, and how that needs a different kind of leadership at that moment.
Yeah.
Okay. I gotta ask, does seminary equip the new generation of pastors to understand that concept, or do you find that outside of the church, it's much easier to introduce this?
So my work is entirely with faith leaders, a lot of times church, but also nonprofit and universities and mission agencies. And a lot of seminary education doesn't have as much leadership development as leaders say they needed. So I end up teaching in that environment, mostly with doctor of ministry students who are mid-career people. But the truth of the matter is that seminary teaches a lot of things, but not usually the leadership skills we need.
So do you feel like it is that mid-generation? I mean, break this down by generations. I'm curious where the hunger is and how that looks in your experience.
Yeah. So one of the key principles is that we've learned over the years is that leadership is learned in the leading. Most people aren't really learning leadership until they're facing a leadership challenge. You can write papers on leadership. You can read books on leadership. But the formation comes when you're in the middle of the challenge. When you're facing the crucible is when your character is formed. So for many people who might be very interested in leadership, they read books or they take workshops or whatnot. The concepts are really real to them. But it doesn't become a practice in their life until they're having to face it, which usually means people are already in the middle of that work.
So what scares me about that statement so much is if I was leading in a business context, in a corporation, I feel like the consequences are mostly in dollar and cents, although, you know, there's definitely going to be how I treat my employees. But for a person who is a faith-based leader, the consequences of that growth curve seems to be people's hearts. And that, so how do you deal with that?
Yeah, well, so one of the parts about this kind of leadership is that it's not the only thing. There are what we call technical problems. So one of the very first things you do when you get into adaptive leadership is you do some diagnosis and you ask, is it a technical problem or is it an adaptive challenge? And a technical problem is not a trivial problem. I would say, you know, when I'm on a plane, I want the pilot to be able to land the plane. That's a technical problem. There's a skill set you have there. What makes a technical problem unique is that it is solved by an expert with best practices. So most of what we teach in seminaries is it's how to interpret the scriptures, how to do counseling, how to handle souls, how to run good meetings, how to be a person of character. Those are really important things. What they just don't prepare you for is what you do when you face the unknown that you're not prepared for. And that's when adaptive leadership comes into play.
That must be hard to teach because you don't know what you don't know until it happens. It's hard to get ahead of that one.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. That's why you have to learn. That's why adaptive leadership requires you to have the humility to learn in real time.
Yeah.
Psychologists tell us that the three hardest words to say are not "I love you" or "I forgive you." It is "I don't know." And especially the more that you have been entrusted with leadership, the more education you have, the older you are, the harder those things are to say. And that's actually when adaptive leadership starts, is when you say, "I don't know," and we're going to have to learn as we go.
I think back to myself as a young church planter, the age of 25, and then later on as the head of a Christian school shortly after I turned 30. I was so cocky and so certain because I'd read a lot of leadership books, and because I could stand up on my hind legs and talk, I was so certain that I was up to the challenge, and I had the answers, and I knew what was going on. And I only lasted 5 years in the ministry for a number of reasons, but a big one, I think, was a discouragement that came because my let me put it this way. It seems to me as though maybe the first fundamental component of adaptive leadership must be an ability not to panic, to know that the uncertain times arise, emergencies develop, and it's not the end of the world. And you don't. I think I would worst case scenario a lot. Is that common?
Yeah. So one of the parts about it is when you face the unknown, you tend to get really anxious. When you get anxious, you default back to the things that comfort you, right? So you either, you pretend, you fake it till you make it, they say.
Right.
Yep, they realized most people can't make it. The stress wears on people and mm-hmm. they end up doing all kinds of bad things to themselves and others. Mm-hmm. Or you end up defaulting back to your old training. So, you know, what most of us did is, if we face something we don't know, we preach a sermon series on it.
Oh, yeah. Ouch. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you know, you default back to your training. You go back to what's familiar. So the hardest thing is to be calm enough to acknowledge that you don't know, that you're going to have to learn as you go, and that the people around you trust you to figure it out with them. And that's what you're really doing in adaptive leadership. You're inviting people into a journey of deeper transformation so that we can face what's in front of us.
Mm-hmm. Boy, this is not just about leadership. You just described every man's life at home when he hits the things that he doesn't know. Yeah. I mean, it seems like we all need that. God, I think a lot of guys feel like they're supposed to take a leadership role at home, but they have an idea of what that looks like that might be pretty clunky and boxed in. And then it has that exact same process of feeling stressed and then faking it, possibly being too big in that moment when it's time to get small and humble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I define leadership as energizing a community of people toward their own transformation so they can accomplish a shared mission. So if you think about it this way, one of the most challenging parts about leadership in any environment is to recognize that it's not about a title, that it's not about having heavy furniture, a corner office, or people calling you teacher or doctor in the marketplace, but it's really a skill set. It's really, how do I lead a process where we're all going to be changed and where we're going to be able to accomplish the thing that's been put in front of us? So I often say that, you know, many people confuse management and leadership. Management is a really important thing. Management is taking care of the complexity of an organization or the different responsibilities of the people and the resources and things that have been entrusted to your care, as my colleague Scott Cormode likes to say. And then leadership is having to take those very same things and take them through a process of transformation. So, you know, the manager would have told Moses on the other side of the Red Sea, hey, I've checked the GPS. I've looked at the map. I've got a couple of people here who've heard stories about the wilderness. It's probably going to take us 6 weeks to get to the promised land. The leader understands that it's going to take 40 years to become the people who can enter a promised land. And that's the difference. Mm-hmm. It's that transformational difference.
Well, I love, what was the last part of how you define leadership, that the shared transformation together? Is that how you phrase it?
Yeah, energizing a community of people toward their shared transformation, to their own transformation or shared transformation, so that they might accomplish a shared mission changing world. Yeah.
So I'm just thinking how that would revolutionize my concept of being father in the house or husband, because it demands first that we've defined what those things are together, that's a community goal within our community of men, within the community of the family. And just in the defining, that's got to be a huge leadership step for someone.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's in the defining it begins the process. So So I often put it this way with people. I say, leadership is ultimately about transformation. That's really what it's about at its deepest level. It's about becoming the kinds of people who can accomplish the thing that you've been asked to accomplish. So when I think about the fact that when I became a father, one of the things is, somebody could tell me all the things to do. Here's a pick up a kid, burp him, change the diapers, feed him, make sure the bills are paid. But what actually made me into a father was the way I had to grow and be transformed to raise my children. Mm-hmm. And so leadership is where I take on the responsibility for transformation. Mm-hmm. And what I tell you a lot of times is there's no transformation without trust. So yes. you have to be trustworthy, but trust is not transformation. Trust is what happens when I fulfill the responsibilities that I've been asked to fulfill. When I exercise my technical competence, to use the phrases out of my own field, when I show, like as a pastor, when I show up and I handle the scriptures well and run good meetings and balance the budget and keep my appointments and practice good pastoral care and pastoral counseling with people, trust is built. Mm-hmm. Transformation requires us to invest trust into this unknown environment where we don't know what to do, and we're going to have to take people through a journey of their own transformation with us, so that we might go through those changes and we might be different. And that's exactly, if you use the example of the Exodus again, that's what the people of God were wrestling with Moses the whole time. They didn't have a vision for freedom. They wanted more bricks, a better lunch, some time off to worship. God gave Moses a vision for freedom. And so they had to keep trusting, can he keep taking us forward toward this promised land? And that as they walked in that, they began to be more and more transformed.
All right. I want to ask a question, but you can feel free to say, Aaron, that is not relevant to this conversation. Move on to the next question.
Okay.
I used to get sent to a lot of leadership conferences, and I felt like there was an idea of leadership that if I lined up 20 guys, I would usually get kind of a Braveheart caricature. The guy up front, he's loud, he's kind of muscly. But there are so many different kinds of leaders, I believe, that are shaped by a person's natural personality. That this guy can be an amazing leader, but it's going to look nothing like that guy. And most of them are going to look nothing like Braveheart. So how does just understanding ourselves and being honest about how God has shaped us, how does that affect how we learn to lead?
Yeah. It's actually a great question, because our mental model of leadership is usually some ideal. I always tell people leadership's a skill set. So the closest thing I can compare it to, because I work at a seminary, is preaching. There are some people who walk into a preaching class who are naturally funny or naturally glib or tell a great story or have been up in front of other people. There are others who are not. They're more reflective. They're quiet. They're thoughtful. Or maybe they struggle with talking in front of people. We teach everybody how to preach. It's a skill set. Some people have certain natural characteristics that you just look toward, but there's a skill set about learning how to be faithful with the scriptures that we can teach anybody. And that's the way I think about leadership. So it starts with, in many ways, knowing yourself, knowing this is the way that I show up. This is what I do. And I think you even see this, that caricature that you just had of Braveheart. Jesus was working against that when John and his brother James came to him and talked about, I want to be on your right and I want to be on your left.
Yeah.
And actually even worse than that, they sent their mother. And what Jesus says to all the disciples, because they all thought, oh my gosh, James and John just got over on us because their mother is more shrewd than our mothers. Our mothers are home. There's mothers here for some reason. Is he said, this is the way the Gentiles lead. It's not going to be that way amongst you. And he calls them to be servants. And notice he calls them all to be servants.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you think about the difference in all of them, the kind of person that they're supposed to be is not to lord over other people, but to be a servant, and you to serve people so that they might thrive in life and they might thrive in the thing that God called them to do is what leaders do.
Yeah, and that's true whether they're leading a large urban church or whether they're leading a home group.
Yeah. Well, I would say I say a mom who gets together in the neighborhood and says, "Hey, this neighborhood needs a stop sign on this corner because people are driving too fast around this corner into our cul-de-sac, and our kids like to play between our houses." Whoever gathers a group of people together to make a difference, and takes responsibility for that is stepping into leadership, and especially if you're going to have to like grow and change, like we're a group of moms who are going to make get a, to, in order to get this from City Hall, we're going to have to grow. We're going to have to learn how City Hall works. We're going to have to be diligent with bureaucracy and red tape. We're going to have to overcome people's biases and work with the neighbors. Some of the neighbors who don't want a stop sign in front of their house, whatever. That's the act of leadership. It's a function, not a role, not a title or a position.
Yeah. Two speed bumps I heard in what you said was that we start with an ideal, which can give us possibly a wrong direction. I'm trying to get there, but if that's not who I am, I'm not going to be the witty person. I'm going to be the reflective person. But if witty is the ideal, that can be hard. And the second one is if leadership is defined by various practical functions. And I certainly see this with husbands and wives. I don't know how many times over the time that I was pastoring, I had wives angry because the husbands wouldn't lead in prayer. He's supposed to be the spiritual leader. Why doesn't he? He's supposed to do that. To which I'm thinking, it seems to be really on your mind and your heart. He can be a good leader by saying, "Honey, you really always remember to pray. Will you please remind us to pray?" Like, that's not being a bad leader asking her to do that. But if I start with those functions, I'm this, so I'm supposed to do that, just like the ideal, it seems like it can set us up for failure.
Yeah, actually. And what's interesting is so many times that ideal is a cultural ideal, just like you just talked about with Braveheart, right? And even the idea that the man is to be the spiritual leader of the home, that's a cultural ideal. That was actually the Roman idea. That's why in Ephesians, you actually have Paul challenging the Roman idea by talking about stuff like mutual submission. And you have the church, you have churches set up with husbands and wives being co-pastors together.
Right.
Right. So what you realize is our cultural ideals about leadership often keep us from actually taking on the kind of influence and leadership that I think Christianity could offer in a different way. Christian faith leaders could offer it a different way. Because it comes out of a different, deeper wisdom.
Taking on and, dare I say, enjoying? I mean, that'd be nice to believe. Well, I love... Go ahead, Nate.
I'm thinking particularly now about Samson groups. We've got a lot of guys who told me just this last weekend, they picked up a new meeting book and they said, I really enjoy the online meetings, but I'm feeling called that I need to start a local meeting where I live. And I'm wondering how many of those guys perhaps might be laboring under the idea, for example, that to lead, they're going to have to be the answer man or the teacher.
They're going to have to be Nate Larkin.
Right, exactly. And if they're not naturally gifted with that gift set, if that's not what they do, then they're just going to shoot themselves in the foot, right?
So
what's a better way to approach it? If I am, I've never started a Samson group before or a group like it before. I'm feeling called to do it. How should I order my thinking to do that?
So this is a really good example of this comes from a Jewish rabbi named Ed Friedman. He was a Jewish rabbi for 40 years in a synagogue in Washington, D.C. He was also a marriage and family therapist. And he used what's called Bowenian family systems theory. This gets back to that point in a second. And he said, what he believed was this, that if you wanted to bring healing to a family, you needed to heal the whole family. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes the pain of the family showed up in one particular person, the identified mm-hmm. project, the identified patient. So right. you can imagine someone, you know, a mom calling his office saying, hey, my son is having trouble. He's starting to fail his classes. We think he might be doing drugs. Please help him. Mm-hmm. What he would say is, I need the whole family to come in.
Yeah.
And oftentimes they would balk, right? The husband's like, I'm busy traveling. The wife is, I'm so sorry. My daughter's got ballet practice every day after lunch. You know, so could you just see my son? And he would say, no, the whole family has to come in. Mm-hmm. Then when they finally came in, he would ask, so what's wrong in the family?
Wow.
And what he would listen to people say, the husband would say stuff like, well, I think maybe, you know, maybe she babies him too much. And mm-hmm. the wife would say, well, I think if you didn't travel so much and work so much and spend more time with him, he would be better. And he's like, this is not about me. And all of a sudden the sister says, you know, I could spend more time with him. I get a little bit too consumed with my ballet sometimes. And he's asked me to spend time with him and I haven't. Ed Friedman would say, kick everybody out of the office except the daughter.
Wow.
And work with her because mm-hmm. she's the leader of the family. Mm-hmm. The leader is the person taking responsibility. So
wow.
Right. So go back to your men who say, uh-huh. hey, I think I'm supposed to lead a group. I would say to them, get some people that you trust and say to them, I need a group and I'm willing to host it at my house, or I'm willing to be the one who mm-hmm. will convene it or put out the website or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I need help. Mm-hmm. You're the leader. By taking responsibility and taking initiative, you're the leader. That's what leaders do. And you can even just say stuff like, I'm not comfortable leading the group. But mm-hmm. Or leading the meeting, doing the teaching, whatever it is I have to do. But I'm raising my hand and saying, I need this group and I'm asking some people to come join me. Mm-hmm. That's the leadership we need very often.
Oh, fantastic. I got my money's worth right there. Okay. That was awesome.
Well, you can thank the late Ed Friedman of blessed memory. So that's
okay. All right. Yeah.
Thanks, Eddie. Oh, not right now. Sorry. So, okay, go ahead, Nate. I want to hear what the follow-up questions. So now the guys who took those books last weekend mm-hmm. were doing exactly what Todd said.
Yeah.
So what's the next hurdle besides admitting I don't know how to do this and asking for help? That seems to be the step two of what you said.
It's a collaborative thing. It's quite clear. It seems to be. It seems to me, from what Todd's saying, an effective leader has got to take a collaborative approach, right?
Very often we do, because by taking a more collaborative approach, we actually have the opportunity for more gifts to be used, mm-hmm. More people to participate. I mean, it's what you see in the New Testament. It's Paul and Silas, Paul and Barnabas, they're always going out in groups. And I do think there's something about that model that becomes very, very powerful. Mm-hmm. And again, the culture tells us there's one expert leader who has all of the answers. And I always say that anybody who tells you, right? Anybody who tells you I alone can solve it, they're lying to you. They're lying.
Yes.
Because things in this world are way too complicated than that.
How do we push back a natural tendency that I saw when we would find new elders? We'd find elders because they were serving. They were gentle-hearted people, all those things. And then they got put in a position of authority and something shifted more often than not, where the position itself, I'm the leader now. And there were various things. Felt like a lot of weight, so they acted different. Made a part of their ego come out that we hadn't seen before. So now that I'm a leader, how do I push back and remain that kind of servant leader you talked about? Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the ways is just by paying attention, like actually being honest, by paying attention to the person. If I believe that I've been nudged by God to take on this role, mm-hmm. I've been nudged mm-hmm. by a group of people to take on this role. They asked me as I am. So one mm-hmm. of the things I can do is be the healthiest version of myself. Mm-hmm. Ed Friedman said one of the big misunderstandings is that we're supposed to try to change other people. He said it almost never works. Instead, focus on your own growth and stay connected to other people.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. If you become an elder in a church and you say, okay, I know I have to learn how to be a good spiritual leader. I don't know exactly what I'm doing. I run my own business, or I've done leadership in other spheres, but this is a different culture and a different way of doing this. Just by taking responsibility for your own ongoing growth and staying in relationship and connected to the people, you'll move the system forward in a better way. And very often, the problem is that we try to bring these other cultural models, other mental models of leadership to this experience. And we don't even realize how often what we're bringing is something unconscious that we were trained in.
It goes back to asking the question, what do I think the ideal that is the expectation? And if the ideal is Nate, he started these groups, so how would Nate do this? Yeah. You're saying, no, the question is, how would you do this? Because here you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this old rabbinic tale that says that when you get to the judgment day and God wants to judge you, he will not say, why weren't you Moses? Because he already had a Moses. Mm-hmm. He'll say, why weren't you you? I needed somebody. Yeah. I needed somebody besides Moses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and as a shout out to the virtual guys, because I go to a lot of different virtual meetings and see the styles of different guys leading it. Man, there are no two virtual meetings, even though they're doing the same script. They are so different in feel, and it's so good.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
We're back to that old John Lennon line, I think. I think he gets credited with it, but be yourself. Everybody else is taken. We jumped over, Aaron, this step that we almost always take with a guest. And we didn't give Todd a chance. We like our listeners to get to know our guests on a personal level. Mm-hmm. We typically do this at the front of the conversation. We're coming toward the end of the conversation. Mm-hmm. But can you give us just a peek into your life and how you wound up in ministry and in this work?
Yeah. So when I was in high school, my parents went through a divorce. And when they went through a divorce, a group of people who were part of this ministry called Youth for Christ reached out to me and cared for me. And I'd been raised in a church, but they really challenged me that there was a God who wanted to know me even better and more personally, understood the things I was going through. And so as a kind of angry teenager, I gave my life to Jesus. And I ended up going into ministry because I wanted other teenagers to experience what I've experienced in terms of both God's love and care and this community of people who cared for me. That meant that over time, I ended up working at a church in Hollywood, California, Hollywood Presbyterian. I became
My parents got married there.
Many did.
That's the Lloyd Ogilvie Church, right?
Yeah.
Lloyd was my boss. Lloyd was my boss. Lloyd is the one who asked me to come on his staff when I was 23. When I got ordained, it was his hands on my head. He baptized my son.
He's the James Earl Jones voice of the church.
He was indeed. And so for 10 years, I was on their staff. Mm-hmm. They sent me to seminary. They paid for my seminary, which meant that I could afford when I decided to do a PhD. My wife and I could scrape some money together and pay one class at a time. I said I crammed a 4-year degree into 9 years so that I could. And I got a PhD, and I ended up becoming the senior pastor at a church in Orange County, California, San Clemente Presbyterian Church. And I was there for 17 years. And about seven or 8 years into the process, our church was doing well by most standards, except that I realized that while all the metrics were going up, the morale was going down.
And I
didn't know why that was.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought in a consultant, the kind of person who does what I do now, who basically took a big look under the hood. And what he said was, the people in this church love you and respect you, but they talk about you all the time. And everybody thinks they're here participating in your ministry. And that means the best people are getting de-energized. They would like to participate in something bigger than your ministry. Mm-hmm. And so you've got a problem. And I didn't know what to do about it. I literally didn't. First of all, I didn't think I was making it about me, but I obviously was. and I didn't know how to lead any other way. So I had to literally learn how to lead all over again. And that's when I learned about adaptive leadership, that it really is, as the environment changes, healthy organizations figure out how to adapt to that environment without losing their core DNA, their core identity. And that led me on a journey that eventually I started doing more consulting, and I ended up writing books on it because I did some leadership work in my denomination and some other places, and ended up at Fuller Seminary as a senior vice president. And then 2 years ago, stepped out of that role so that I could do full-time working with Christian leaders on the, on this work.
And you look way too young for that story.
I started when I was young. I started.
I wonder. So you were an amanuensis of a guy who was larger than life. Lloyd Ogilvy was larger than life. Do you think that without realizing it, certainly unconsciously, did you absorb some of that? Was that kind of what was coming out in San Clemente? You recreated what you'd seen, and
Absolutely. I mean, I would say, well, Lloyd was an amazing technical leader. Going back to what we talked about earlier, he was. He was one of the, he was literally voted one of the 12 best preachers in the English speaking world. He had a dynamic ministry and dynamic leadership and was a incredibly godly man, and was really in every way a good mentor and model for me. The problem is, without even trying, it was always about him. He was the superstar. Yeah. He had deeper voice, better looks, smarter than everybody. He just was that guy. So I thought, if I'm going to be a leader, I got to be like him. I got to get a PhD. I got to be a preacher. I got to, you know. And so what I didn't realize is, without even trying, I was modeling a form of leadership that used to work, that actually was profoundly powerful in the 20th century. But as the world changed, it didn't work as well. The world changed too rapidly. Needed more collaboration. It needed a different style. It's not the old, what they call the great man view of leadership that was part of the 20th century. And I needed to learn to lead all over again. That's what happened to me.
You said something that struck me, because I had a friend, Corey Melia. Don't know if you ran into him in San Clemente.
Corey worked on my staff for a year and a half.
Wow. This is such a small world. Anyways, when Corey was at a certain church, they decided to make some radical changes, but they weren't adaptive changes, because it did change the entire DNA. And that clicked for me, that this idea of adaptive change is not disruptive all at once. It's gracious shepherding.
Well, and it's also paying attention to, this goes back to the ideal, like, if it's what's true about a human being is you need to be yourself, it's also true about an organization. Like, like a church's DNA is its values. So here's one significant thing. When Lloyd was leading the 20th century, everybody in leadership talked about vision, cast a vision and inspire people. Today we live in a world where we don't know what's coming. It's like we are in a fog of change. So more important than vision are our values. And what happened at that church, because I happen to know a bit about that story, what happens to a lot of churches is that a new leader comes in and changes the values for their vision.
What that does
is that literally it's like someone walking into your family and saying, okay, we're going to change the way we do family now. And even if you thought that was the best thing ever, it's going to be so deeply disruptive.
Yes.
Because, I mean, think about this: unfamiliar and family. Family and familiar are the same root word. So if you take somebody into a completely unfamiliar experience, it's like you unfamily them.
Yes, that's so well put.
They get abandoned. And so what they want is, they just want to go back. And sometimes that's really negative. But the way forward is by starting with your core values, your deepest things. Like in the words of Jim Collins and Jerry Porras, once you're clear on what will never change, then you can be prepared to change everything else.
Wow.
So you have to start with what's the most important thing.
Right? Yeah. We should be paying you by the hour. Crushing well, it.
By the minute right now. I'm watching this thing go. And I also know we're up against a hard stop. You have been very gracious to fit us into what I know is a busy schedule, Todd. I'm watching the clock here, and I know you have other commitments. So, thank you so much for taking
Todd,
time.
How do people kind of track with what you're doing? Get some canoe books, get some crucible books.
I hire you as a consultant to come in and look under the hood in their church.
Yeah. So I lead what's called A.E. Sloan, S-L-O-A-N, A.E. Sloan Leadership. It's named after two people who were mentors to me when I was in San Clemente, Al and Enid Sloan. They were from Alburnett, Iowa. They were great, gracious, loving people. And I named my company after them because they were dedicated to making sure that as a pastor, I had a great ministry and a great life. Mm. And that's what I believe. I think when we're taking people through good, healthy change, you end up having a great ministry and a great life. And so A.E. Sloan Leadership. And if you Google that or you Google my name, you'll find me and you'll find my company. And you can find all the books, all the books on all the places you buy books.
Awesome. Okay. Todd, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Listeners, we will be right back here on the Pirate Monk Podcast. And welcome back to the Pirate Monk Podcast. Man, it is fun to talk to someone who's just an expert in their area of ministry and the world they live in.
Yeah. And you can tell there is kind of this calm, settled, not pushy, he's a great presence, a knowledgeable presence. Yeah, he just kind of exudes wisdom, I think. He looks and smells like a consultant now, I would say.
But in a good way. If anybody thought that was, I don't know what people's images are, but Nate meant that in the best way.
I did, absolutely, yeah.
Like, this is a man you'd like to consult with. I would have liked to have talked for a lot longer and heard some of those one-liners that are paradigm shifting, just like, here's a sentence. Mm-hmm. And they just hit like a ton of bricks on old paradigms. So that's awesome. I hope that this is encouraging to both old leaders of Samson groups, both virtual and in person, and especially to the guys who are wanting to start and might have that ideal out there that they're trying to chase, instead of just, like Adam Young said this week, don't focus on your kids, focus on yourself, and that's going to be the best thing for your kids.
Yeah.
I think it's the same thing in this context. Focus on who am I, who did God make me to be, and just watch how that's amazing for the guys that you're loving on and serving.
Yeah.
Now, Nate, would you sing the John Lennon song as we kind of wrap it up?
No, I will not.
Okay.
I will not. That's my gift to the Samson Society. I will not sing.
Oh, you have a lovely singing voice.
Yeah. Well, already we have come to the end of the episode. This is one that I am going to re-listen to a couple of times, I'm quite certain. As we move forward in the Samson Society, we're at a time of transition and growth and change. As Tom Mocha put it so well at the National Retreat just last weekend, moving as an organization or an organism, whatever we are, the Samson Society, moving from childhood stage into adolescence. How do we hang on to the values? What is it that does not change? Let's get absolutely clear on that. And then what are the challenges? What can we change in order to meet the challenges ahead and take advantage of the opportunities that are out there?
Nate, you do know if it takes 20 years to get through each stage of growth, we're both going to be long dead before we get to college.
That's awesome. I've already accepted that fact. Yeah. All right.
Well, if you've got thoughts, questions, insights, stories from your weekend at the summit, send it to piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com. Is that what it is?
Why is that not?
That doesn't feel right tonight. Okay. piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
That's it. Well, that's it for this episode of the podcast. Until next week, I'm Nate.
And I am Enrique.
And that was Todd. He's gone now. And we are all your pals on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Yo-ho!
The Pirate Monk Podcast is produced by members of the Samson Society. Send your feedback or questions to piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com. Please give us a 5-star review on iTunes and share the podcast with a friend. For more information, please visit samsonsociety.com.